Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next Producer's Picks, highlights of a conversation heard on a previous episode. On today's show,
they come together to create this declaration of sentiments that really speaks to their frustrations and their goals. And that does open the door to the women's suffrage movement. And it disseminates from Seneca Falls, but it takes some time to really take root in a substantive way. And we see that especially in Buffalo and other places, because while now in our modern sensibility, we would say this is a wonderful thing, women having the right to vote. Why wouldn't you jump on that right away? Well, there were a lot of societal issues that would have made it very difficult or very dangerous to support women's suffrage, especially during this early period.
We welcome back Lindsay Lauren Visser, historian for the City of Buffalo and executive director of the Niagara Aerospace Museum. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. To start off, we revisit the first time Lindsay Lauren Visser joined the show back in March. I sat down with her to discuss her newly appointed role, what we can expect from the position, and some of the local connections Buffalo has to national history. You're the first City of Buffalo historian since when?
So to the best of my knowledge, 1979. And it's interesting because I think one of the first challenges of being city historian was, could I identify the last city historian? Because if I couldn't find it, nobody else was going to. So I did some digging and I did some research. And to the best of my knowledge, it was Walter Dunn, who was the former executive director of the Buffalo and Erie County Historical Society. And when he stepped down in 1979, the position was never refilled.
So on your website, you say you didn't fully appreciate the city of Buffalo until you moved back. Why was that? And what about your travels made you come around to a fuller appreciation of this fair city?
I think for everybody who lives here, you're just used to, in some respects, some of the stories, some of the history, which I might add is really only scratching the surface in so many respects. But you kind of think every city must have history that's like this, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I left and had the opportunity to kind of experience something a little bit different that I came back and went, whoa, hang on a second. Buffalo is so important to so many moments in our state and our national and our international history. So it was such a natural thing for me as a historian to come back and say, hey, wait a minute. These are stories that need to be told. I love telling them. And I just kind of gravitated toward it and I haven't looked back since.
And we were talking off air, you mentioned that the history of women in this area, in not just Buffalo, but Western New York, is very prominent, very important.
That is definitely an area I have a very pronounced soft spot for, because I really, truly believe the women of Western New York are just something exceptional. And even zooming out a little bit, New York State, we truly do have, I think, one of the best claims to women's history nationally. Just, it's incredible. But especially during this time period, that 1882-1920 period, there are women doing amazing things. Belva Lockwood is always one of the ones I love to talk about, because not only is she the first woman to legally run for the presidency, she's also the first woman admitted to the Supreme Court bar. She's the first woman to try a case in front of the Supreme Court. And as if that weren't incredible enough, she also turned around and said, great, now that I'm allowed, I'm going to make sure everybody else is too. Mm-hmm. And so she lobbied to ensure that African Americans could practice. And she personally sponsored the first African American to try a case before the Supreme Court. Incredible woman. What I love in particular is that when she ran for president, she ran against Buffalo's own Grover Cleveland, because
incredible.
Buffalo's everywhere at this time period. We also have our nation's first daycare, Mariah Love. We have the first congresswoman to introduce equal pay for equal work legislation at the federal level. We have women who were, I mean, so instrumental in social issues, too. Mary Talbert was formative in the Niagara Movement, which was the precursor to the NAACP. We have just women doing amazing things. And then when we zoom out to the state level, you have the first female vice presidential candidate. You have Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman to run for the presidency. You have Hillary Clinton, who is the junior senator of New York State, running mm-hmm. as the first female candidate on a major party ticket. Our current first female governor is from Western New York. So, I mean, we have just this tremendous, tremendous legacy of women just blazing trails and just breaking through all obstacles in their way.
I can hear it in your voice. This is what you're passionate about.
I love it. This is, and how can I not be? I mean, it's such a gift to have such a rich history to draw from. I mean, it'd be one thing if I were trying to convince you of the historical significance with names you've never heard of, but
right.
I mean, my goodness, when I start saying these things, they're accomplishments that have value beyond Buffalo. Mm-hmm. They changed our world in some respects. And to say they're from here, it's the coolest thing in the world.
Take us through the process of becoming the City of Buffalo historian, first since 1979.
I think having the background in political science came in very handy because it involved a lot of lobbying, which mm-hmm. I was not expecting. So Doug Kohler is the county historian, and he has been doing great work since he took on the position. And in fact, he's the first county historian in that almost exact same time period gap, because they consolidated the history position or historian positions for the city and the county. And then when they were vacant, they just never refilled either. County got filled first. He was doing great work. There are so many historians for the municipalities within Erie County. And when we were celebrating the bicentennial, one of the most pronounced absences was the fact that the city of Buffalo did not have a historian. And that seemed like a fairly tremendous oversight.
Pretty glaring omission.
Right. Kind of the heart of a lot of the history, right? And so it was a process of trying to figure out, okay, who do we reach out to try to put this on somebody's radar, because it had been such a long time. Nobody really mm-hmm. knew even what the process was. So I took a scattershot approach where I just went to everyone. And I started talking to the Common Council. I started talking to people in the mayor's office. I was talking to anybody who had anybody's ear. And as former Deputy Mayor Crystal Rodriguez Dabney likes to tell the story, there was this moment when Emerson Barr ended up coming in and saying, the Common Council has this idea to appoint a city historian. They already have a candidate. She's great. She's very well qualified. And Crystal laughs because then she's like, I also have a candidate. I mean, I think mine's great. She's really well qualified, too. Who's yours? And they're like, Lindsay Lauren Visser. She laughs. She's like, that's mine, too. And so by the time I get to the mayor's office for the meeting, there's a stack of papers on the table in front of him. And he's like, do you realize what these are? And I was like, no. He said, these are all of the letters, just the letters that I have received about appointing you as historian. That's not even counting the phone calls. He's like, what did you do? And I just thought, you know what? Like, since nobody really knows the procedure here, let's get everybody on the same page. And so I think by the time the announcement actually came out, there were plenty of people who were just like, okay, great. She's been, wait, was it? She historian? I don't know. Like, it had gotten to a point where I think I had just become so intrinsically linked to this position that it was just such a natural thing. And uh-huh. so many people were just like, okay, good. Glad that that's sorted out. But like, okay. So that was, it was great too, because I think one of the things that really did help in terms of navigating that system and knowing how to navigate that system, as a municipal historian, you do kind of have to balance the interests of the city and the government, and also understanding how to work within the networks that exist. And so mm-hmm. I think that experience of figuring out, okay, how to even get the position and how to get the support that I need is going to be very helpful in terms of getting the support from now other parties to have the resources to celebrate history in Buffalo and to really do a lot with this position. So I definitely think there's two distinct sides to the role, and obtaining the position really relied upon that one municipal side.
What are three things you hope to accomplish as the historian for the city?
Great question. I think the first is there are so many wonderful historical organizations throughout the city of Buffalo. They are doing amazing, amazing work. Some of them are entirely volunteer run, and it can be hard to continue to have an up-to-date network of who is in charge of all of these organizations. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing is taking stock of everybody who is doing this great work and finding opportunities to connect them more closely together. Because our history, even though each of these organizations has carved out their piece of it, our story transcends individual locations. There's all sorts of points of connection. The people who are involved in telling these stories were multifaceted. So there's different parts of their lives that touch upon different museums or historical sites or agencies. And finding a way to connect these groups so that they can combine their resources and do more when there are so few resources sometimes for historical organizations, right? So how do we maximize what we have? Mm-hmm. How do we use this position as a historian to highlight the good work that all of these organizations are doing to get people more excited about it and to get people looking for them? I mean, when you think about it, you're not going to think, oh, you know what? I'm going to go to the Transportation Museum if you don't even know that there's a transportation story in Buffalo to be told, right? So it's really important, I think, to get people thinking about the history, because that will naturally lead people to the places where the history is kept. So that's my first mission, is to really, you know, get a little bit more hands-on in the historical community. Obviously, the second is the schools. Mm-hmm. As I said before, really finding ways to make social studies education more engaging, more exciting, more hands-on, and more locally focused. There's so many great stories to tell, and stories that tie into that curriculum, that framework that tells the national story. There are things that are happening in Buffalo, and we have more content knowledge and more depth than I think we're really utilizing at this moment. So working, like I said, to support the teachers who are doing great things already, let's try to lift them up as best we can.
For our second conversation, we spoke on the 104th anniversary of the passing of the 19th Amendment. We discussed the suffragist movement and how Buffalo helped contribute to its success. This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and today we are talking about the women's suffrage movement in and around Western New York with City of Buffalo historian Lindsay Lauren Visser. Lindsay, it's always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, Thomas. I love being here. Careful, don't say that. I'll just keep coming back.
So this month, the month of August, marks the 104-year anniversary of the 19th Amendment becoming law, granting the women the right to vote. But we cannot start there. That is neither a starting point nor an end point.
Absolutely. I love the way you put that.
Because this movement began almost three quarters of a century before 1920. Lindsay, before you talk about the early suffrage movement, you do have a caveat.
I do. And thank you for reminding me, because I almost rolled right into that. So when we talk about the suffrage movement, one of the most commonly used terms is suffragette. And that is actually a pejorative term that was used by a lot of anti-suffragists to mock the women. And what happens during this time is that in the UK and in the United States, you have the women's suffrage movements running concurrently. And in the UK, the women embrace this and they actually use it as a badge of honor and they roll with suffragette, and it's a very acceptable thing to call them. In the United States, the women did not like the term suffragette. They preferred suffragist. And so out of respect to these women, I do endeavor to say suffragist instead of suffragette. However, I actually have been educated on both sides of the Atlantic, and some habits die hard. So occasionally I will say suffragette, and I don't want to have people coming at us and being like, doesn't she know the difference? I do.
Right.
I do. But there are some habits that I have not been able to kick. I still spell labor with a U, and occasionally I will say suffragette. So as long as we're mindful of the fact suffragist is the preferred term, I think we're okay.
Yeah, I don't want to have any other historians on my neck for the next couple months. All right.
It's okay. You can send them to me. It's my fault. I did this.
So let's talk about the early suffrage movement, Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention in 1848.
Yes. And if you haven't been, it's such an easy day trip from Buffalo. I've actually spent a lot of time in Seneca Falls this summer, and it's been absolutely wonderful. But that really is the seminal moment when we talk about the birth of the women's rights movement, the women's suffrage movement. And it stems from a lot of women who are frustrated from being disenfranchised and also reaching out to other communities that have been typically overlooked. And so with Seneca Falls, what we see is actually a beautiful combination of African-American attendance and women and people from across the region. And they come together to create this declaration of sentiments that really speaks to their frustrations and their goals. And that does open the door to the women's suffrage movement. And it disseminates from Seneca Falls, but it takes some time to really take root in a substantive way. And we see that especially in Buffalo and other places, because while now in our modern sensibility, we would say this is a wonderful thing, mm-hmm. women having the right to vote. Why wouldn't you jump on that right away? Well, there were a lot of societal issues that would have made it very difficult or very dangerous to support women's suffrage, especially during this early period. There would have been a lot of instances of women being accused of being unfit or insane and even institutionalized for having radical beliefs. There are very few protections for women at this point as mothers, and it would have been very easy for their husbands to take their children away from them. So to devote your life to this radical cause at this early phase of the women's suffrage movement would have been very difficult and very dangerous. So we see especially, I think, in this time period, it not really taking root in Buffalo, but you see a handful of individuals who have access to these ideas very early on and carry that with them in their later career.
Now, if I was a successful businessman at that time with my wife who was a suffragist, could my business be affected if not only my wife was speaking out on these issues, but I was also, you know, full-throated endorsing what she was saying.
Oh, for sure. Reputation's everything during this time frame. I mean, it still is in many respects, but I think to put your neck out there for something like this, you did really open yourself up to criticism and people scoffing at you, making fun of you, avoiding your business, or even kind of being dismissive of you or making horrible comments about your wife. It's so unfortunate. But at the same time, I think when we look at, you know, even the course of history in general, when new ideas emerge that aren't, you know, immediately embraced, there is a lot of backlash. Mm-hmm. It is very controversial. We still try to navigate these things, and we see often the worst side of humanity coming out in reaction to these new ideas. And that was absolutely the case with women's suffrage.
So you mentioned the movement doesn't really gain a lot of traction in Buffalo at first, but something changes.
It does. But I do want to say Belva Lockwood actually is one of the individuals who ends up coming into contact with Susan B. Anthony, because Belva Lockwood's a teacher and she's actually running a girls' school and ends up kind of becoming immersed in these suffrage ideas. And she really does carry that with her. And so she kind of becomes, in that early suffrage movement time period, one of, I think, the most influential and impactful women, even at a national level. And she's from here, of course. but what I love about Belva is she felt that the law was the answer to these kinds of issues mm-hmm. and the lack of opportunity women faced. So she wanted to become a lawyer, which as a woman was a very difficult thing. She ended up going to DC and finding a law school that would take her. And the school actually that she attends becomes, I believe, a precursor to George Washington University School of Law. And she goes through, she completes her degree, ends up getting to graduation. They refuse to give her and the other female students their diplomas.
Wow.
Yeah. And so she actually petitions the president of the United States to intervene. And to everyone's great surprise, he does, and basically says these students have completed their required education. They should get their diploma. So that at least allowed her to then try to gain admittance to the bar. But she quickly found that as a woman, she wasn't eligible to try cases in federal courts because the bar didn't allow women to do so. So God bless her. She drafted legislation and personally lobbied Congress to get the law passed to allow her and other female lawyers to practice in federal court. So she becomes the first woman admitted to the Supreme Court bar, becomes the first woman to try a case before the Supreme Court. So this is huge and monumental in its own right. Absolutely cemented her place in the annals of history. But she doesn't stop. She also ensures that there's space for all voices in federal courts. And so she personally sponsors one of the first African-Americans admitted to the bar. And he goes on to try the first case that an African-American tries before the Supreme Court. And in 1884, she decides she's going to run for president, which is just incredible when you think of the fact that women can't vote. She couldn't vote for herself. And because Buffalo is just at the heart of everything, 1884, she's running against the former mayor of Buffalo, Grover Cleveland, who ends up being successful in that election. But she's on the ballot. She gets votes. And she's, I think, one of the really significant early pioneers of women's suffrage. And she does make women's suffrage an issue that she talks about quite a bit.
From my admittedly little bit of research. There were at this time different suffrage movements, an anti-suffrage movement, a competing suffrage movement in the state of Massachusetts. So a lot of moving parts in the mid to late 19th century.
Yeah. Anti-suffrage really did become a movement in its own right. And it had a lot of very prominent voices, especially at the local level. And women that you might think, really? You're anti-suffrage? Most notably, Mariah Love, who is the founder of Our Nation's First Daycare, big supporter of working women who really wanted to improve their lives, very philanthropic, very influential in the community, was anti-suffrage. She felt that women already had too many burdens, that the vote was just another expectation that was going to be placed on them, and didn't think that it was productive in terms of addressing the issues that women faced. And that was a very common thread. Mm-hmm. There were, again, a lot of women who felt that they had more power outside of the ballot box in terms of influencing the course of events by just having conversations with the people in power or really going about solving the social ills through philanthropic work. And so for Mariah Love, she, in some respects, and to her point, was able to do more for working women outside of having the vote than she would have been able to with her vote.
Now, that brings me to the question, how common was it for these women to speak to these, obviously, men in power? I mean, is it how would you compare it to like these days? I mean, I can walk up to Chuck Schumer and ask him about some things.
Yeah, but I suppose it's probably easier now. But part of it, too, is you do have a slightly different culture at the time. But a lot of the women who have the time to be either pro or anti-suffrage are in that position because they have the time and the financial security to do so. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time we are talking about wealthier white women because that was a group that could afford to be involved in these issues either for or against. So when we think of it that way, having access amongst that group to influential individuals would be fairly common. This is also a time period where social clubs are thriving. The 20th Century Club, the Women's Club, the Social Club, the Buffalo Club. So it would have been fairly common to be able to be in a social atmosphere where, say, maybe not Chuck Schumer, but, you know, the mayor of Buffalo's wife is at the 20th Century Club, right, and you can chat with her and then she can go home and tell her husband what she heard. And there is a little bit of politicking behind the scenes. So there's certainly women who feel like this is sufficient. We don't need the vote. It's not going to yield the same results as a well-placed conversation is going to, or like I said, even their own philanthropic actions, whether it's supporting a museum, supporting a social movement, making a daycare or a settlement house. They see these as being more efficient uses of their time and energy. And then there were others who were opposed to suffrage for ideological reasons. One of my absolute favorite women in history, Frances Folsom Cleveland, was anti-suffrage. And at first, I was just devastated by this fact until I realized she had, a very good and compelling point. She was one of the first educated first ladies. She felt that unless women had been given the opportunity to pursue education on equal footing with men, giving them the vote was kind of mixing up the process, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was essentially going to enfranchise women who didn't know how to utilize it as a tool for their own advancement. And so in many respects, they may end up, for lack of their own knowledge, relying on their husbands to determine who they're going to vote for. So rather than giving women a mechanism to achieve independence, you're effectively enfranchising their husbands twice. And so there's...
That's so interesting.
Right? And so it's not like the traditional anti-suffrage, women don't need the vote, from coming from the men. It's women who are looking at this and really grappling with the issue of the day and saying, maybe this isn't the right time, or maybe mm-hmm. there are things we need to do first. So there is some disagreement in even, I think, within the suffrage community of, you know, what are the necessary steps in order to be able to actualize ourselves in our democracy.
We get to 1878, women's suffrage amendment introduced in U.S. Mm-hmm. Congress, and then we move over to the middle of the movement.
Yeah,
1901, Pan American Exposition Board of Women Managers, right here mm-hmm. in the city of Buffalo.
Yes,
talk about it.
Well, again, drawing from I think that tradition really of the 20th Century Club, you do have a lot of very influential women who want a voice in one of the biggest events in Buffalo's history, and so they do take a very active role, and you do start to see women being more active and more engaged. But Mary Talbert, I think, is a great example of somebody during that time period who was incredibly involved in the Pan American Exposition and really was sitting between two worlds as a woman of color, in that she was actively campaigning for the advancement of African Americans, but then also actively campaigning for women's suffrage. And so, especially in that like transitional time, we start to see women dabbling a little bit more with getting out into society and really pushing for these things in Buffalo. And it starts around this time. You start to see the suffrage groups form. It's still a little in its nascence in some respects. But women like Mary Talbert, who had a national platform, really did lend some gravitas to mm-hmm. women's suffrage in a way that I think perhaps up until that point in Buffalo especially, it just didn't have people who were talking about it or willing to champion it in such a prominent way.
You mentioned there was, you know, class distinctions in the suffrage movement, but there are also, segregated along, the movement was segregated along racial lines.
Yes.
To some degree.
And what is really interesting is in 1848, when you talk about the convention, it really is a movement that stems from the frustrations of the African-American community and the frustrations of women. And they're in it together in some respects. They're both disenfranchised groups. And so a lot of the white women suffragists were worried about walking a fine line of ensuring that they could retain the support of some of these southern states, because if the South decided to reject it as a block, that would be it. It'd be the mm-hmm. end of the conversation. So there were a lot of these racial undertones to it. You do have groups of white suffragists, groups of black suffragists. There is some energy between the two, but is fractured. And then especially after the passage of the 19th, you do see even greater fracturing in terms of women being united around one single thing. I think the 19th Amendment, or the amendment to the Constitution concept, really was unifying because it was a clear end goal
yes.
that seems to have universal appeal. Once that was obtained, you start to see the diverging ideas on how best to achieve equality. And that does have implications on class, on race, and on all of these things that we deal with in society.
Yeah, we see that in so many movements throughout history.
Right. And sometimes I sit there and I'm like, had you just kind of lined up the next thing and said, okay, girls, get back out there, let's go. I don't know, maybe we'd be further ahead than we are now. But, I am still grateful for all of the women who made the 19th happen.
And then moving to the later movement, June 14th, 1914, women's suffrage demonstration here in the city of Buffalo. I believe it is the first of its kind in the city.
It is the first of its kind. It's the first, widespread, massive parade. And they do have big attendance. But what I also love from the Buffalo history side is they select Flag Day as their day of doing this big protest and demonstration. And Flag Day is a holiday that was championed by another woman in history, Sarah Hinson of Buffalo. So I do love the feminine patriotism, just the,
yes.
the symbolism of selecting a day about celebrating our democracy and our patriotism that was designed by a woman to celebrate a flag that was designed by Betsy Ross. So when we talk about Flag Day, it is such like a girl power moment that I love that that's the moment that they said, this is the moment we're going to really launch hard the women's suffrage movement. And when we look across the country too, World War I really does start to shift things for women's suffrage in a more obvious way, because women start occupying a different role in society. When the men go off to fight and they're working in factories, they're taking on more responsibilities. Their sons are being sent to war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, women are recognizing that they are functioning in society in a more meaningful way, and they're not given the opportunity to make decisions about the direction society is going in. And so it becomes a more glaring juxtaposition between what they're currently doing and what they're currently being denied. And that does help cement the suffrage movement and accelerate and augment it in a much more pronounced way.
So who leads this demonstration in the city of Buffalo?
That's actually a really good question. I believe it is the Erie County suffragist group that ends up leading it. And in fact, when we talk about the Buffalo of Six, which we'll probably do in a second here, one of those suffragettes, Ada Kendall, was the president of the women's suffrage group in Erie County. And that actually does predate that 1914 movement and the demonstration that they had in City Hall. So we did have some groups that were in existence. The National Women's Party had a chapter in Buffalo. There are a lot of organizations that are starting to mobilize. And so you do see more unity amongst mm-hmm. these groups, again, because of all those issues, as I talked about with the war and just the augmenting of suffrage. That's kind of how it comes into fruition in Buffalo, in that it's kind of the moment where as a city we shift a little bit more to becoming more supportive of women's suffrage.
1917, New York becomes the first East Coast state to enfranchise women. And then obviously August of 1920, 19th Amendment becomes the law of the land. You mentioned the Buffalo Six, but let's dig into it. Who were these women and what was their part in the suffrage movement?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned before, that window of time from 1914 to 1919, when we really start moving things along, is so iconic for, I think, what we think of as women's suffrage. When mm-hmm. If you were to think in your head of an image of a suffragette, you're probably thinking of a woman in white with her purple and yellow sash, and she's holding a sign in front of the White House, yes. right? That is this moment. That is the iconic shift in women's suffrage. And six women from Buffalo were actively a part of that and did jail time as a result of their involvement. So, in an effort to really turn the pressure on, Alice Paul, who is one of the national women's suffrage leaders, encourages the picketing of the White House in an effort to really put this issue front and center for Woodrow Wilson. And of course, he's trying to stave off a war in Europe mm-hmm. by 1917. We're in that war.
Yes.
So his focus is really shifted toward international issues. And I will say this about Woodrow Wilson. He was very politically minded in terms of international relations, and the League of Nations and all of these things are really his wheelhouse. So this domestic mm-hmm. issue of suffrage is like, oh my God, won't these women leave me alone? And so he kind of inherits it. It's not as though he's fundamentally different from any of his predecessors. The only party, if memory serves, the only party that really had managed to make women's suffrage a plank in its platform was the Progressive Party, which was run by Theodore Roosevelt back in 1912 as his ploy to try to, you know, win the presidency away from his Republican challenger, William Howard Taft. And the combination of those two is what makes Woodrow Wilson president. So really, this is just kind of so new. Yes. He's like, what the heck is going on here? So Alice Paul really encourages these women to be what she calls silent sentinels, which are peaceful protests of the White House. Some of the campaign signs are a little racy for 1917, right? They're like, how long must women wait when you send our sons to war? Mm. And like really provocative,
yes.
Pointed criticisms. And at one point, Wilson is just like, this can't go on. And so he has them arrested because it's complicated, right? You can't arrest them for picketing. It's First Amendment protected. Yes. So he has them arrested for the obstruction of traffic, which seems absurd, but works. So they get rounded up. And so this happens throughout 1917. And in fact, one of the women from Buffalo, Janet Frothingham, is in one of the first groups to actually be imprisoned for this. And so what happens is they're picketing the White House. They're arrested. They're put in front of a judge. The judge says, okay, you need to pay a fine, right? And again, as I mentioned, these are women who can afford to pay the fine.
Mm-hmm.
They refuse. And so they're sent to Occoquan Workhouse in Virginia. This is the first time that women of this social class are being sent to a workhouse. And so when their relatives catch wind of this, they're horrified, and especially with how these women are being treated. And so the first wave that Janet is a part of, she ends up being pardoned very quickly afterward because it kind of becomes a bit of a scandal, right? Woodrow Wilson, you can't have put these women in workhouses, right? This is insane. So he pardons them after 3 days, and they refuse to leave. They're like, we don't want the pardon. We want the vote. And so this kind of gives rise to, in some respects, the badge of honor, right, of being mm-hmm. arrested and sent to Occoquan Workhouse. So you do see women from across the country, including Buffalo, who pick up and they go to Washington specifically to picket the White House. And so you have people like Amy Yingling, who's a teacher from Black Rock. She goes down with her aunt, who actually it's her aunt who really wants to picket the White House. And and her aunt's too old. And they're like, well, you can't, but you can. And so Amy, who's like, I thought I was just here to stuff envelopes, is like, okay, I guess I'm picketing the White House today. So she ends up in prison, and Hattie Krueger, who is a nurse from the area, also goes down. The two of them are part of the group of 14 women that I think I mentioned earlier who were subjected to the Night of Terror, which mm-hmm. was really is traumatic event in which by November of 1917, the women in Occoquan were becoming increasingly what the guards would have considered unruly. And the reason behind this was they were hunger striking. They were protesting the fact that they were not being held as political prisoners. They were protesting the conditions that they were being held in. And it culminated in this night of abuse toward the women where they were beaten and they were force-fed and all of these horrible things happened. And Hattie Kruger actually ends up testifying in court with two of the other suffragists about her experience. And the judge at that point declines to look into it any further. But this was, again, starting to change the public perception of the treatment of these women.
Mm-hmm.
They're peacefully protesting, right? So in addition to the ones that I mentioned, you also have Janet Frothingham's sister, Margaret, who's a teacher at Buffalo Public School 42. She goes down, and I actually love the newspapers from this time because it does kind of give you a little bit of a glimmer into what people were thinking. And they're like, Margaret Frothingham doesn't have to be jealous of her sister anymore. She did her own jail time. It's like, okay, what a way to phrase it. But That is true, and it was in many respects like a badge of honor to go do this time. But what's interesting in her case is she is actually dismissed from her job for her political activism, and they protest the Buffalo Public School Board, and the Buffalo Public School Board upholds the decision to terminate her. What's significant after the fact, though, is that the D.C. Circuit Court actually ends up hearing a case from other picketers of the White House and upholds their legal right to picket and overturns all of these convictions and whatnot. So the suffragists are vindicated eventually. It's mm-hmm. too late for Margaret to get her job back. She actually starts working for the Red Cross. But there's just these wonderful characters. One of the other ones, Edith Eng, I love her. Her rap sheet is amazing. She's accused of starting a suffrage riot at an event one time. So she goes to an anti-suffrage convention and basically screams at the senator who was anti-suffrage, and a riot ensues, and so she's arrested for that. Over the course of her life, she pickets the White House. She's one of the first women to do the Watch Fires of Freedom, which was another tactic as things were starting to progress more in 1919, where the women would burn speeches from Woodrow Wilson in front of the White House, in like a perpetual keeping the fires going, like they would watch them. So they call them the Watch Fires. And so she was arrested for everything that she did jail time 5 different occasions throughout her stint with suffrage. So she really is, I think, one of, to my mind, the more aggressive suffragists. But
the real rabble rouser.
She really was. And when you see her picture, too, even later in life, she's a little older woman and she's holding her New York flag. And you could just see the iron resolve in her face. She's just awesome. And then there's Ada Kendall. And Ada is one of the first journalists really working. Her mother was actually a journalist, too. But she's one of the first to be working for one of the major newspapers in Buffalo. She ends up being the leader of the Erie County suffragists, and she also went down to Washington to picket. She did 30 days in Occoquan and actually ended up doing 6 days in solitary confinement for use of profanity and failure to follow the rules. And I just feel like this is the quintessential well-behaved women never make history moment These women were absolutely like, we are not taking this anymore. And so I love reading their rap sheets and being like, yes, like this just makes you better. So those are the Buffalo 6, as it were, the ones who actually did jail time and endured some really traumatic things in jail to ensure that women could vote. But what's, I think, really important to note is that this is all occurring summer and fall of 1917. So this is at a point in which New York has already accepted women's suffrage. So these are women who now have the right to vote. And yes. they are out there willing to do jail time because one state is not good enough, right? There are other states in the union that have already passed women's suffrage, but they are out there and they are absolutely saying, we are going to keep fighting until all women have the right to vote.
New York State could be considered the epicenter of the suffrage movement. But just given our conversation, do the women of Western New York and their achievements get overlooked when the larger suffrage movement is discussed?
That's a really great point. Personally, I do think New York has one of the best claims to hotbed of women's history in our nation. But because of that shift that we start to see in 1914, a lot of cities were sending women to picket the White House. There are just incredible numbers. They're coming in droves. They're able to keep the pressure on Woodrow Wilson almost around the clock. And that comes down to sheer numbers. And so I think it's important to note that there are so many women who did amazing things, and that this particular battle was not won by any one great woman mm-hmm. championing suffrage, but it was won by women who were in droves willing to put their necks on the line and take the heat to do this. So to my mind, I think it's incumbent on us as a city to really take ownership of our story and say, these are our women who did this thing.
Yes.
And they are part of a larger group. But if we aren't singing the praises of our Buffalo Six, there are so many other places that are going to be singing the praises of their suffragettes that it does tend to, I think, sometimes not get the attention that it deserves. And these women don't get the recognition that they deserve simply because we haven't spent enough time talking about that history.
Talk to me about the through line from Belva Lockwood to Charlene Mitchell, to Shirley Chisholm, to Hillary Clinton, and now Kamala Harris, and the many other women who have run for president and vice president in between those times.
Yeah, you have to love the fact that New York is so central to that story in so many ways, right? So Belva being the first woman to legally run for president. Technically, Victoria Woodhull ran a few years before her.
Yes.
But I always make that distinction because there are so few requirements constitutionally to become president, being 35, chief among them. So she was 32 at the time. I mean, it just it doesn't have the same resonance, if you will, legally in terms of her ability to had chief through fluke of vote. One, she wouldn't have been eligible to serve. So Belva really is the first woman to legally meet the requirements run when votes. So to have Belva coming from Western New York, to have Shirley Chisholm coming from New York City, now buried in Buffalo, to have Hillary Clinton, junior senator of New York State, I think Buffalo and New York State in its entirety has really given rise to, I think, some of the most impactful women in politics. And I really do think there's something special in the water here because mm-hmm. our women go on to do amazing big things. But I think that also speaks to the fact that we do have this history and this legacy of taking on this issue. So I'm not surprised that so many women from New York end up being the women to push the boundary and try to break that glass ceiling a little bit more. But it is wonderful to see that there does feel like this line that connects all of these women who really were the first of their kind.
Now, the question that's going to stump you.
Oh.
What do you find most fascinating in this time period from 1848 to the signing of the 19th Amendment into law?
You can't do this to me. All of it. Every second, everything is amazing. I love it all. I can talk about it all. Yeah, that is a really tough question. I think I do have this absolute wonderful soft spot for Frances Folsom Cleveland. And I think looking at her and the evolution of her beliefs has been so interesting to me. Because when we look at First Ladies, her legacy really almost gets distilled down to being an influencer, if you will, in the 1880s and 1890s. Her likeness is used extensively for advertising. That's part of the reason why the Baby Ruth candy bar comes into existence, right? Because of her Baby Ruth. She accidentally kills the bustle because a rumor gets started that she doesn't like that particular fashion. And so it falls out of vogue. And she's like, where have all the bustles gone? And they're like, we thought you hated it. And so she has this really, like, image-oriented legacy, I think. And the truth is she's actually an incredibly educated, brilliant woman in her own right. She's one of the first college-educated first ladies. And later in her life, she ends up on the board of Wells College, which is where she studied. She ends up involved with Princeton University because, yes, Grover Cleveland is mayor of Buffalo, former Erie County Sheriff, governor of the state of New York, born in New Jersey. Yes, I do know that fact. So for her to be anti-suffrage and even her views on certain issues throughout her life, staunch Democrat, would not vote for FDR for the third term. And that was another interesting moment where I was like, Frances, what are you doing? But she was very ideological. And as I said when we talked about the anti-suffrage, her belief was that in order to have women really actualize to a point of independence, education was a necessary step. And I do think the suffrage movement was made stronger for some of those criticisms.
Yes.
Because immediately after the passage of the 19th, you have the League of Women Voters form, and that entity exists explicitly to educate women voters, to better equip them to make good use of their vote, and to have the knowledge required to really exercise their civic rights. And so that, I think, was a direct response to some of these criticisms about the lack of electoral education or the lack of general education that women had at the time. Throughout time, obviously, that improves. But looking at her beliefs, looking at her as, in some respects, an example of her time and the way that women would have maybe struggled with this and had their beliefs evolve over time. Because she did, when she got the vote, she wasn't ideologically opposed, but she didn't decide not to vote on principle. She was an active voter. Mm-hmm. So I think looking at her, I really like, because I do think she's so indicative of so many other things. So she's got the soft spot in my heart, as evidenced by my use of emojis in my email to you about her.
So as the City of Buffalo historian, what anniversaries should we be on the lookout for in the next few years here in Western New York and in the state?
There are so many great things to look forward to. 2025 is the 200th anniversary of the Erie Canal, and we have so much planned for it, especially down at Canal Side. Buffalo is the terminus of the canal, but it's important to remember the Erie Canal goes through huge parts of Erie County, so Black Rock, Amherst, Tonawanda, these are all parts of that story. 2026 is the American semi-quincentennial, so 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. I know, it's incredible to believe, and that's another great opportunity to take stock of what has occurred in the last 250 years. Obviously, we spent a good chunk of time today talking about women and their role in our history. But there's so much that can be celebrated and discussed and commemorated. We also have in 2027 the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery in New York State. So that'll be Freedom 2027. What feels like a million years away from now in 8 years will be the City of Buffalo bicentennial in 2032, which is going to be upon us faster than we realize. Right. but then even on Monday, we had our very first Erie County Historical Commission meeting, and we were discussing all sorts of other anniversaries that are within that same time period. So the Erie County Parks are turning 100. The Buffalo Niagara Airport is turning 100. There's the commemoration of Lafayette's last visit. So there's all of these things that I really hope will give our community a chance to take stock of what happened here. And Buffalo and Erie County in Western New York has had so many influential individuals, events, things that have started here or really had a major moment here that not just shaped our region and our state, but shaped our nation and our world. Mm-hmm. And it's really our birthright in some respects, right? Like as Buffalonians, yes. to talk about that and to take that opportunity to really take a good look at what happened and maybe have some of the difficult conversations, have some of the individuals who haven't gotten the recognition that they deserve. Just have that moment as a community to say, this is who we are, this is where we've been, and this is where we go from here.
Now, City of Buffalo historian is not the only hat you wear.
No.
You have another title and you have an event coming up. Tell us about it.
I do. So in my day job, I am actually the executive director of the Niagara Aerospace Museum up in Niagara Falls, which is an amazing museum. If you have not been, you should absolutely come up and see me, because if you think Buffalo history is cool now, I promise you there is so much about our contributions to aviation and aerospace you probably don't know about, and it will blow your mind. We're just, like I keep saying, we're important in everything, so it's hard to like prioritize what's the coolest. But aerospace and aviation is really cool. And on September 7th, we will be having our Hangar Dance, which is a World War II 1940s era themed party, complete with a live big band and swing dancers. Mm. Yeah. So you can
bring your zoot suits.
Exactly. Dance the night away, surrounded by historic aircraft. It's actually a really cool fundraiser, but more importantly, it does benefit our STEM education and our collections care. So two very, very important things to our organization. So if you are interested or would like some more information, you can find out more about our Hangar Dance on our website, which is NiagaraAerospaceMuseum.org. Good luck. There's a lot of owls in that middle section. Hang in there.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks. We thank our guest, Lindsay Lauren Visser. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.